Hi, everybody. Wonderful you're gathering here on Memorial Day. You could be out, you know, doing Memorial Day weekend things. So it's a great honor to be here. And my name's Steve Wilhelm. I'm one of the assistant teachers and standing in for a guiding teacher. I guess that's the way to put it. Has anyone here online or in person never been here before? All right, and great. Well, it's great to be here. So I'm going to flip around our normal order of things, just to shake it up. And we're going to sit for a few minutes first, and then I'm going to give a talk, and then we'll sit. Okay, because there's some stuff in the talk that might want to come up during your sit, and we'll have a break after the sit, so hopefully that'll work for you. And it may not be as long as usual. And we're going to have a short breakout groups here and in person to be able to talk about, because this is about Memorial Day, and, like, you know, on one level, people close to our hearts. So a chance to share about that, and then we'll have some discussion. And part of the deal in terms of what folks have to do out there, Malalia, am I saying your name right? Yeah. Anyway, yeah, say it again. Malia, thank you. Malia out there, thank you so much. She's out in Zoom world, and so she's going to set up breakout rooms. So we'll have after the end of the sit, we'll have a 5-minute break and then 12 minutes of breakout rooms, which adds up to 17 minutes. So if anybody doesn't want to be, they can leave and come back, but not leaving in the middle, because that's hard for her to do. Okay. So much stuff. Okay. So let's just sit for about 5 minutes just to gather ourselves. So that means, you know, just nestle right in, kind of let go of what you were doing. This is a precious moment to just be aware. And we can land our awareness on our breath. I'll ring again at the end. Okay, and I sort of apologize for throwing all these ideas at you at the beginning about what we're doing, but so Memorial Day, signed up for this months ago and gave a lot of thought to what would be helpful, looked into it, because technically there's lots of layers. I'm going to introduce a bunch of layers here that may be helpful for you. Because on one level, technically, Memorial Day is about fallen soldiers. That's the historical origins of this holiday we share, people who died in combat. So for a second, let's think about that and how parallel that is, because sometimes, you know, they were filled with fear, but they continued. And that's kind of how our Dharma life sometimes is. We're filled with fear and we continue. And there are sacrifices that we offer to the world. But to continue, even when it's hard, is a real lesson we learn from these soldiers who died. So let's just one moment of pause to honor them. And then Memorial Day is also about recognizing loss of people who died, who passed in our personal lives, about our personal lives. The circles of people with whom we are connected and that define us in many ways. And when we're remembering them, honoring them, it helps us see ourselves better and helps us recognize and heal traumas so we can move ahead into freedom in ways that can benefit others. So it's a real powerful act of honoring passing of people. So I'm going to explore 3 different layers of this, having to do with rebirth, having to do with ancestors, and having to do with people we love. And we'll see how these all tie together in ways that I hope will be helpful. So when we open our hearts to people who preceded us, we realize, we discover we're not alone. There's a sense of community through time. We're not just isolated beings floating in kind of space or in the middle of stuff, which is how it often feels for people in the modern world when we're all, you know, everything's all digital, everything's all immediate, and we kind of can forget about the power of this amazing lineage that brings us to this point here in 2026. So starting with the whole idea of rebirth, and I have a question. How many of you here, you can raise your hands, have some conviction that rebirth is in fact the case? Anybody? Many? Any other convictions? A few. Okay. So most are on the hand of not thinking it's the case, probably. Yeah? Okay. Well, that's okay. I will point out that the Buddha said it was the case over and over, so, you know, for whatever that's worth. But so for this journey, why don't, if you could at least think about it metaphorically, for those of you who think that is the case, great. For those of you who are not so sure, think about it metaphorically. You can see where it touches. Okay? So if, in fact, each of us has had countless prior lifetimes, how do we hold that? You know, what does that mean to us individuals here in 2026, in this particular form that we're in, this moment in time? I spent a lot of time looking at history, and very interesting YouTube videos with AI now to recreate moments of history. It's pretty fascinating, and other stuff like that. And it brings the past more in the present, because we start to think, who was I? This man is not an I, it's not Steve, but who was this continuity of consciousness in prior times? How do we work with that? What does that mean? And what did I do? And when we look back through history, you know, human history, so much of it was brutal. As brutal as it seems, it was way more brutal pretty much for all of human history until now, just constant warfare and slavery, and it's amazing how brutal we humans managed to be with each other. So when I think about sort of the prognosis for my own prior conduct, looks kind of grim in terms, and maybe for y'all, I don't know. But you know, we probably did some nasty stuff in former lifetimes, and hopefully we did some good stuff too. It's a mix. But to really kind of bring that in, and there's sort of an embracing of how we were, choices we made. Because sometimes in this lifetime we can, you know, make a mistake, do something, and then we'll really fault ourselves or be in our own case, criticize ourselves. But when we think of many, many lifetimes and this continuity of us and what we must have done, there's a way in which we can hold it more gently. Because this being that we were did all kinds of mayhem that was partly a matter of the time that we were before. But those, from this point of view, those beings who preceded us are in some sense us, because there's streams of karmic consequence. You know, as they always say, the Buddha said, the one thing that gets carried forward is karma. When you die, everything else is gone. All your possessions, your self-identity, the people you knew, it's all gone, except for karmic consequences. That carries forward. So I'm clear, you know, my name's Steve, that none of my prior lifetimes were Steve. But there is a connection happening. And I learned to kind of honor that and work with it. And in terms of this Memorial Day, kind of hold it in a way. This karma of what I did conditions this me that is now, and it has this long antecedence. And, you know, arguably that's the case for all of y'all. So these beings in former lifetimes who preceded me kind of formed what I am now by their choices and actions. And they felt pain and loss and suffered. They had families and children. They were persecuted. They had good crops and bad crops, times of feast, times of starvation, They probably did nasty things to other people some of the time and good things to other people others of times. There was times when they were healthy and young, and then they got sick, and then they died. So that's how it is, right? That's how it is. So let's, you know, just for maybe, you know, take a few minutes to consider who we might have been some former lifetime. Sometimes we have little hints. And, you know, cultivate your intuition and see what that means. Work with it as you will. But it's interesting to look into. And in terms of memorial, we can hold those prior versions of ourselves with a kind of honoring, a kind of memoriam of appreciating that they're sentient beings who had a karmic connection with us. How amazing to look back in history and feel that possibility. We never met, we have no names, but there's some kind of honoring we can do here on Memorial Day for these prior lifetimes of ourselves. And this, you know, there's, the way it's presented in the Dharma, you know, this lifetime by lifetime moving forward. I mean, we're all gathered here because somehow in that long journey, there was some kind of conviction or intent arose in us that brought us here, choosing to be in a place of contemplation and Dharma as opposed to, I don't know, out in a boat or at folk life or eating too much or whatever. I'm saying, you know, they're all fine things, but somehow you all chose to be here because of some intention to move toward Nibbana, and that history is part of what brought you here. Now, another interesting second area I wanted to touch on was birth ancestors, like our ancestry going back through our bloodlines, not the karmic thing, our actual ancestry. And here in the 21st century, you know, with everything moving fast and people from all parts of the world, for many of us, this whole idea of bloodline seems of little import. My son lives in Texas. He's a coder. He just couldn't care less about who his ancestors were. It just absolutely does not register. It's pretty interesting. He just doesn't care. And I suspect that's how things are for us these days more so, and that's okay. But that's not how more traditional cultures see things. And there's something to learn from how more traditional cultures see things. In particular, in China, traditional Chinese cultures, they keep these lineage books. They're called Jaipu, which I'm sure I'm mangling, but Jaipu, these lineage books that are held for families. And some, there's a Kong clan, has documented lineages through written registries for 5,000 years, tens of thousands of ancestors. I've seen movies about these incredible gatherings where these they have, and there's this real sense of who I am is part of this incredible lineage of people. And that means something too, you know, it really does. Kind of like a lot of things in the Dharma, we can hold it and treasure it and let go simultaneously. But it does, it is significant. It brings this human heart aspect, and in terms of this being Memorial Day, to honor, oh my goodness, all these people did all these things to have each one of us here in our bloodline. There were parents who brought up, well, our own parents, for starters, brought us up, fed us, kept us safe. Here we are, all in one piece. Thank you, parents. But then their parents and their parents and their parents, going back for hundreds and hundreds of years, people we have no idea who they were. I'm mostly Italian, so, you know, lineage, so, okay. People in the Italian peninsula 50 generations ago were having kids and took care of them and goes on and on. So to really honor that, that's pretty cool. That's part of broadening our hearts to honor beings. And right through the same thing, you know, people took actions. Some were generous, some weren't, just like our karmic ancestors. Kind of some mixture of kindness and confusion and greed, kind of like that. Isn't that how many of us live? It gets clearer when we're on the path, but most people are kind of dancing around like that. But we can hold that in our hearts, honor these ancestors. How wonderful that is. Kind of a memoriam for here on Memorial Day. Now here's where things get interesting. Because in much of Buddhist understanding, particularly in Tibetan tradition, but it pops up all over the place, weaves together these two strands. That is, karmic people being reborn often are people with whom they had connections before, from a Buddhist point of view. So that means if, like in your family, you may have karmically had connections with those people in other lifetimes, not to mention your bloodline, two different avenues of interconnection going back for thousands of years that interweave. It gets really interesting that way. There's these great, I've seen these great Tibetan things where this lama looks at this little family thing, and but actually the, you know, the father was once the daughter and the dog was once the mother, and they were all interconnected like that. So this means, one way of looking at it, the winds of karma that kind of brought us together with these same beings lifetime after lifetime. You ever wonder if you're in a particular connection with someone? I've gone through this with my stepson. Particular connection with someone is like, so there's something so intense about it. Like, where'd that come from? Why is this happening with this particular person, that where there's a particular difficulty, a particular thing to unwind, just maybe from a former lifetime? You know, or those of you who have a spousal, a significant other, and there's this continual process of unwinding your stuff, right? And you ever start to hit chords that maybe were not just from here? You know, you can sort of say, oh yeah, this trauma, that trauma from my childhood, but then it goes back. So if you start to think of it that way, then our connections with the people close to us get really, really deep, because it means not just this lifetime, but prior lifetimes and our bloodline all interweaving. And our grandmothers and mothers, we've known each other before in all kinds of different forms and ways. And we can honor that, you know, we can honor that and hold that in a memoriam. In the Samyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses, 15.14, the Mother Sutta, the Buddha said, "It is not easy to find a being who has not formerly been your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your son, your daughter." The Buddha said that. Just the same thing. All this interweaving. It's really interesting. It's really beautiful. Because this really helps us, you know, hold the people close to us in a whole different way. You know, someone you sort of, we can concretize, oh, this particular person, this kind of problem. But what if that person was your mother before? Or your son, right? Or the family dog. You know, what if that person was in a whole different role, and how can we hold that in our hearts and honor the flexibility of it? Because we're growing in ways it's hard for us to understand, you know, in our journey of growing, how we are in any level of different forms. And, you know, I'm kind of a sort of a cup half full positive kind of person. So I've been end up honoring the people who came before, kind of just great sense of appreciation, whatever their, you know, whether or not they had slaves or whatever they did, still this sense of appreciation and some honoring and some holding and embracing. And some, you know, the fact that, you know, for myself, they got me to where I am on the path. Something happened. Something in the lineage happened that helped this be here. And it doesn't mean they were Buddhists. Maybe they were right-living Muslims, you know, or Christians, or whatever. It doesn't matter. But it's the intention that matters. It's not the path. You know, the intention that matters, the good heart, the kindness. That's what matters. And so this question kind of who we are and who we were become all part of this same fabric. And we can really hold that in a way that honors ourselves and honors others. It's a really beautiful way to look at this whole fabric of life. So Memorial Day, you know, it brings a recognition of death. And we turn toward it, turn toward death, but also recognizing it's part of life. You know what they say, as soon as someone is born, they're moving towards death. It's just how it is, that arc, and, you know, maybe it goes around and around in terms of many lifetimes. But we're inescapably on both. I just found out yesterday, a dear friend of mine, Anthony Belante, you wouldn't know him, but he was a photographer when I used to be a journalist. He was this unbelievable photographer, grew up in Hawaii, totally hung loose, but he also was in three tours of duty in Afghanistan, flying like Chinook helicopters, those ones, the two rotors, those big Boeing ones, you know, perched on the side of a hillside with small arms fire coming at him, rescuing people and stuff. The guy was so mellow. He was just a sweetheart. He just died, boom, at 58. Incredibly vigorous, vibrant surfer kind of person. So boom, you know, so we have to just be ready, have to embrace this possibility of death all the time. And the more we have this long view about it, it's not quite the same thing. It's not this fear so much. It's part of a larger sphere. Not fear, larger sphere. So we can turn towards, you know, in our own life. This is kind of where this goes. But what about the people we have in our own life? How do we relate to them on Memorial Day? And in this larger context that we've been talking about, it kind of broadens who they are. We can hold them in a deeper way. It's not just this uncle that kind of come and gone. It's like, oh, uncle that we've been connected with maybe for a long, long time. So we can hold it with much deeper sense of appreciation that way. So these people, you know, we've known in this lifetime, maybe we've known them repeatedly. Maybe they're part of our biological lineage. Maybe we've known them for thousands of years in other lifetimes and other forms. It's such a beautiful way to hold them tenderly, with great respect, and see that they're not so different from ourselves. If we've all had all these different forms, our sense of like me in a male body kind of vanishes, you know. Female, male, large, thin, child, all floating around, but sentient beings navigating through the world. Okay. So now we're going to sit for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have, can y'all bios okay? If you can handle it, okay. So then we'll have a 5-minute break and 12 minutes of breakouts. And so this is what Ken asked me to think about. I want to encourage not too many people online. How many of you are there out there? Kind of 30. Oh my goodness, a lot of people online. To encourage you to stay for the breakout, because we're going to get a chance to, you know, honor each other's feelings about people who may be gone. Encourage you to stay. But if you really don't want to be there, then after the meditation is over and I hit the gong, just leave. Punch out of Zoom and come back in about 17 minutes and we'll have finished the breakout. And if you leave, that gives the person arranging the breakouts the ability to do that, because you'll know who's here and who isn't. That make sense? Any questions? Okay, sweet. All right. So let's sit for 30 minutes. Looks good. And, you know, I did this partly because if any of that hit a chord, I mean, we're doing, you know, start the time and then I'll just say a word. Just settle in. Settle into this moment. Just sit up straight. So as you know, our primary practice is mindfulness practice. So we rest our attention in this moment. Cultivate our mindfulness in this moment. And if, for instance, something comes up that I talked about that catches your attention, you can bring that into your practice and don't think about it, but just bring your attention to it. It's called sometimes called analytical meditation, which is a funny word, but just to bring your attention to it and see, and then let it go. Only if you wish. Then we'll ring the bell at the end, and then we'll have a break, and then we'll do breakouts. Okay, hi folks. So everybody's getting all arranged here in person, and let me just give a prompt, and then Malia, you can send them to breakouts. All right.
Okay.
So you can get in groups of three if the math works, and if it doesn't, then you know, or maybe yeah.
Yeah.
Four, it looks like. There you go. He's in person. Okay. So you know, Memorial Day. So please share in 3 minutes, 4 minutes each, three groups, three times, 4 minutes each in groups of three is 12. So please share for about 4 minutes. You know, someone who passed, someone that you hold in memorial, and what their legacy brings to your life. You know, what do you learn from them? And we got a few more people here, so we can reshuffle a little bit to get groups of three. I see four over there and one here, so try to get a group of three. But what their legacy means to your life, what it brings into this present part of your life. And if the stuff that I shared about rebirth and that longer view informs how you see it, great. But that's up to you. Okay, so we'll have 12 minutes, and you can start here, and Malia, please do your thing. Okay, so here we have some really lovely to see people so engaged, and I heard little sort of snippets of people talking about people and their families, which is really wonderful. So this is a time for we get some time to explore together. So that could be in the form of questions, thoughts, sharings, whatever moves you, and kind of alternate between in person and online. How do we do the mic thing? All right, Cheryl's got a mic. So stick up your digital hand or your real hand. Digital hand's good for online because then you pop up to the top of the screen and we can see you because there's 18 people out there and maybe some more coming back. And I'd be curious also, you know, if any of what we were talking about rebirth and how those things weave together, if that resonated for anyone or meant any, whatever that meant for you, let's put it that way. So anything you want to share about your family, about your life, your loved ones? Yeah, this is.
Is it mic on?
Yeah.
What? No,
mic is on.
Oh yeah, people are that can't hear you.
Sorry.
Bingo.
Now,
yes, thumbs up.
Now
thank
you can hear me. Okay, Aunt Sadie, she was the oldest of this immigrant family. My mother, the first seven were born in Hungary. My mother was the youngest and was born here. But it started me thinking about maybe some of my positivity and optimism and can-do kind of attitude might have come from my Aunt Sadie. Mm-hmm. She was really important. She was my first boss. She ran a little dry cleaners in Detroit, and I worked for her, moving clothes around. And so just thinking back about the lineage, and also I wondered whether part of my proclivity towards optimism was my reality that I was not born in a country where people were trying to kill me and my family, and so I didn't need to leave. Mm-hmm. And so just that gives one more of a sense of positivity. So they all left because of the pogroms in Hungary. Anyway, thank you, Steve. So
yeah.
So I brought in Aunt Sadie, and then there was Uncle Dave, and we didn't get a name for a grandpa's, but we all brought in our families to our conversation. It was really sweet.
But I feel like a real heart holding Aunt Sadie. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was only about this big.
Okay, yeah, anybody else? Someone online? Curious screen. Yeah.
Since I've got the mic, I'll bring someone into the room. I recently found out a friend of mine had passed unexpectedly, and he was known to many as Mayhem, and he was the most... he was a connector of people and somebody who cared for almost anybody who he bumped into as family immediately. And what I recognized with a kind of startle when I learned that he had passed is that I couldn't actually imagine the world without him in it because of the way he was such a, you know, lightning rod for people coming together and somebody who made you question how you could love other people. And it made me just feel like, wow, I really want to honor him by bringing more of his spirit into my life because he is not here anymore. But we need that in the world still.
And what was his relation, forgive me, at the beginning?
His relation with me?
Yeah.
He was a punk that took me in when I was trying to figure out how to be a person that could love people more openly and showed me how I could do that.
Yeah, it's great how these kind people, surprising kind people. That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. Curious screen configuration, but it is what it is. Oh, I know what's happening. I'll be up to sharing. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Hand up. Emery.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for your talk and for bringing up all of this kind of new and different information and new and different topic. I've been meditating and, you know, dabbling in Buddhism for about 15 years and then attending SIMS for about 5. And I've never heard any talks about reincarnation or, you know, past lives. And I didn't know that that was something that the Buddha mentioned over and over and over again. So that's, I just really enjoyed the teaching and enjoyed knowing this new sort of facet of Buddhism. Sometimes the version we get in the West is, you know, a lot of the more sort of religious aspects of it have been cut out. So I loved hearing that. And I also agree with you that, like, thinking about our ancestors and thinking about how many incarnations we may have had, it helps me be less attached to my current incarnation. It's just like, oh yeah, just like a bead on a long, long necklace or something. It's just, yeah, just one. And then I'll just also share that I have 3 sons, and I have always had the feeling that I've known my oldest son for eons, lifetimes. Like, he was, the day he was born, he was on my shoulder, you know, just holding him. And he moved his little head out and looked up at me, and we locked eyes, and it was like, oh, you. And I've always had the sense, I don't know if we were like brother, sister, I think we might have been enemies at one point, but you know, maybe partners, king and queen, I don't know. But man, I really have always had that strong feeling and have never had any teaching to go with that. So that was just a gift tonight, and I really appreciate your...
Yeah, well, that's really beautiful. Just a couple of thoughts, I think. You know, when the first teachers, Jack Kornfield and Joseph and folks like that came over way back when, I think they were very skillful in how they chose to maneuver, bring the practice in a way that it would work for people and not freak people out. Sort of for many of us, including myself, I mean, I'm a, you know, former journalist and pretty much a show me person. So believing in something that we can't see directly is anathema to many folks. I totally get it. And having said that, you know, it's interesting. I've been to Asia a bunch of times, and in Thailand, say, just people, rebirth is clear as a bell to them. There's no question whatsoever. So, you know, we have to maneuver and see what we find out as individuals on the journey. And by the way, the technicality, the word rebirth is actually the word to use in Buddhist world versus reincarnation, because reincarnation has the implication that there is a, it's more of a Hindu approach, that there is a concrete sense of self which is reborn, whereas rebirth is we're reborn, but it's not an I that is reborn. There's a continuity of consciousness, but there is no inherent self that is reborn, which is a very subtle area to be maneuvered. And then one other tiny aside, that in my own journey, this particular question, I actually think I started off in the Dharma like when I was about 8 years old and got clear that I was going to die. And it's like, how was I going to make sense out of that? And that's really driven me in my spiritual path my entire life, because, you know, there's an end game. What are you going to do with that? But I also never wanted to, I went to church a few times. I was never, didn't grow up Christian, just tried it out. And the whole idea of having faith in something they had no proof for, it's like, no, I'm not going to do that, you know, just to make you feel good. That's, I'm not, no criticism of my Christian brothers and sisters, but that's just how I felt about it. So I've been looking for, I mean, proof is a funny word, but I've been looking for strong evidence about it. And a pivotal point is really continuity of consciousness. Is there strong evidence that consciousness continues when the body isn't? Then we've already crossed a threshold that then rebirth becomes one of the possible options. It could be heaven, whatever. But we're not just mechanical, chemical products of a physical brain. So that's kind of been really interesting to me, and I've actually paid a lot of attention to a whole lot of stuff. So along with being a Dharma practitioner, I've actually been around NDE stuff a lot. I personally have never had an NDE. I know a lot of people at this point who have had NDEs, and that's pretty profound. I mean, I know a whole lot of people that they die. Thank you. Near-death experience. Thank you. Yes, a lot of people have had near-death experiences. I know them. I've talked to them, hung out with them, and it's pretty amazing stuff. So, and the last thing I'll say on this, and then I'll jump out, is that the International Association of Near-Death Studies is the global organization which is doing research, published papers in regular, in the Lancet and Straight medical journals. A lot of these people are doctors who noticed this pattern happening of NDEs and started doing research. So it's not a bunch of goofy new age people. These are like doctors and, you know, credentialed people doing stuff. And the 50th anniversary of the coining of the term NDE was last year, when several of the doctors were saying they think within 10 years that the scientific community will be accepting continuity of consciousness because the evidence is coming in. We'll see. But this August, IANS is having its annual conference in Bellevue at the end of August. Big deal. It'll be like 800 people from around the world with green tags or people who've had NDEs. And we're going to have a panel of two Buddhists and two NDE experiencers talking about continuity of consciousness. Ajahn Nisibo and Sangye Kadro, who's a very senior female Tibetan monastic. We had both genders, both traditions from Srivasti, and two NDE people. So enough of that, but Yeah. So, and we have a person from the floor here.
You kind of broke my brain with that a little bit. So,
can you say your name, please?
Kummel.
Kummel?
Yeah, Kummel. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting topic. You know, the one thing that really stuck with me, well, one, I think I appreciate you distinguishing it between the Hindu version and the, I guess, Buddhist version. I think when I hear it, I hear the Hindu version, and I was raised with that, and I detached myself from it because it felt like something I didn't want to mm-hmm. associate with. I also see the Buddhist version as a negative as well. I don't know exactly what it is, but I kind of see it as a dismantling. So I guess, yeah, I don't know. I feel like the less words I put to it, the better. But at the same time, death is an interesting topic, and I'm glad we're kind of going into it. The one thing I really appreciate about what you brought up that came up for me was the idea of karmic consequences. I thought that was really beautiful and interesting. And I, the person that I kind of brought up, well, I went to a memorial yesterday for my friend's mom, and I got to see like my friend kind of going through that experience. My dad's also kind of going through some, you know, he's just getting older, and like I'm experiencing what it is to needing to let go of him. And at the same time, appreciating the karmic consequences he's been put out into the world for me, you know, and it makes me also want to put out more, I guess, positive karmic, you know, consequences, and by practicing and being a better, you know, I guess, moment to moment person, you know, like the more it kind of ripples out. So I just wanted to kind of reflect on that experience for me.
Yeah,
thank you.
Just a couple of thoughts. One is the word karma. Karma in Sanskrit, kama in Pali, means action. So to really think of it in terms of action, you know, and body, speech, and mind, and how that ripples forward, and how one way to just look at it is how actions of body, speech, and mind condition our mind states. And if our mind states then continue, then that's another way of understanding what karma is, which, by the way, the Buddha declined to get into the weeds about the technicalities. He would do noble silence when someone tried to get him to describe how it works. It's very interesting. And you're origin from India, correct? Yeah, one of my other roles is I lead Eastside Insight in Kirkland, which means we have a lot of folks from India, which is so interesting. I have a lot of India karma. I've been to India 5 times. I got a lot of India karma in me or something. But there's a whole lot of people in our Sangha who come out of Hindu tradition but moved into Buddha Dharma. And the area that's... And I end up, like I do one-on-ones with people, and 3/4 of people I talk to are people from India. It's really interesting. And a lot of times, part of what they're working with is the sense of a self that continues through many lifetimes versus the Buddhist understanding of emptiness is so radically different. I mean, that's where the Buddha, that was the transformational core change that he made, in a sense. It's a beautiful, but a struggle for people to get their heads around who have come out of that tradition and have, for whatever reason, have moved into Buddha Dharma and kind of trying to get that one.
Yeah, I think that's kind of how I see it, the dismantling of self. I guess you meant it as emptiness. I might need you to talk about that. But,
yeah.
But I see what, you know, people who come from Hinduism come from, you know, we're, there's also a social element to it that's adopted to it, which can be, you know, not good.
Yeah, we did a series on anatta, which is not self. And maybe I could just say that it's not, I hear you. But it's not dismantling of self. It's actually in our mindfulness practice, we're paying attention moment by moment. And a lot of what comes up is basically, how do I say, all these different aspects or all these different facets of that make up our sense of self come up when we're practicing. We remember stuff. We feel parts of ourselves. All it's almost like you can see this mosaic of me appears. And the more we see that, we realize that every of those facets has a cause and condition and an origin, but none of them is intrinsically me. So it's not dismantling self. It's that when we see clearly, it falls apart. It's very different. But I appreciate you bringing that up because people can think that. And it's just seeing clearly, you can't find it. We can't find it. I mean, you know, try for yourself. Not my words. You try it. But you are trying it because you're here. And we can't find it. So anatta self-reveals. It self-reveals. Yeah. That's beautiful. Thank you. Got some hands. I see anybody online. I want to make sure we're not.
You've got to get to your gallery back there.
Got to get back to gallery. So bear with me for 1 second. Gallery. Thank you. I don't see any hands up online, so unless I'm missing. Yeah.
I guess for me, very strongly, is this on?
Yes.
It's on. Yeah. I'm Deborah. I really cannot believe in anything other than the finiteness of a life and consciousness. When our consciousness is in our body. So when the body is dead, is when we die, it's gone. But that to me, that makes it so important to carry that the way a deceased person carries on is through our memories.
Okay.
And that there's carrying, maintaining the memory of the people important to us who have died is so important. I mean, the person in my mind right now is my grandson who died by his own hand a year ago. And just carrying on his memory of what his life was and the impact he had on family and friends around him is just so important that if the memory goes, the person's gone. So we have to keep the memories going.
What was his name?
His name was Frederick.
Frederick, I'm so sorry. That happened. Frederick did that. Thank you. Okay, anyone else? Yeah, no.
Hello, my name is Amal.
Amal.
Yeah. So I was pretty interested in the idea or the concept of anatta or emptiness. It might be a very beginner question, but when you experience that emptiness, is that the same as death? Is this how it's understood?
Interesting question. So the question is, when you experience emptiness or anatta, is that the same as death?
Yeah. And also in Indian traditions, I hear this word called shunya. I'm not sure if that's the same meaning.
Shunyata.
Yeah.
Shunyata is another word for emptiness in Mahayana tradition. It's a very interesting, it's a beautiful question. And perhaps it's a metaphor, but often people say that the process of practice is like a continual process of falling away, of conquered self. So in a sense, a dying, without being negative about it, but a dying of self. You know, continual sense of letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go happens inherently because we see through any sense of concreteness. So there is a parallel there. I wouldn't say it's exactly the same as death because I haven't died yet, so I can't tell you. But there's a parallel there anyway, sort of a metaphoric but useful parallel.
And is that the same as the ego death? Ego death? Is that the same as the ego death that people experience with psychedelics or?
What's the word I'm not getting? I'm sorry.
Ego. Ego.
Ego death. Yep. That's, parallel. Yeah, parallel. I mean, ego, it's interesting. I mean, I'm glad you said it that way because it's subtler. Anatta is subtler than death of ego because ego is more like how one gets pumped up about themselves. And so you might say humility is the opposite of being full of ego, I guess you could say. But still, humility can be still within the sense of not seeing that there is no inherent self. So they're kind of two parallel, but not quite the same. Anatta goes deeper.
Okay, got it.
Okay. And since the rebirth thing seems to be a interesting newness for some folks. Any other thoughts about that? Here we got it online. Claire. Come on, there you are.
Hello, okay, hi Steve.
Hi Claire.
Good to see you.
Yeah, really good to see you.
Talk tonight.
Oh yeah.
How you? I was just thinking this.
Are you in Bellingham?
Yeah, I'm in Bellingham. Yeah.
All right, good to see you.
Yeah,
that's,
you too.
That's so
thanks.
Great.
Yeah, totally. I was just thinking it's really interesting how when we're talking about the more non-physical explanations of existence, how people become convinced that like the Western Abrahamic religions are correct, or some of the Eastern traditions, Buddhism, Hinduism, whatever. Right. It's interesting because there's no evidence for any of them. And also the absence of evidence doesn't mean that something doesn't exist. So I think it's really interesting, especially like when us as Westerners, when we adopt like some of the Eastern traditions, especially because a lot of us have like totally chucked aside the Western traditions. And I don't know, sometimes I see us transferring belief systems from the Western traditions onto the Eastern traditions, but I think sometimes people don't know they're doing that, if that makes sense.
I think I tracked it all. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I just think it's an interesting, it's interesting to just like examine why we think one tradition is more accurate than another when there's not any evidence for any of them.
Right. Yeah, just not black and white. Yeah, I agree. And
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I go ahead.
Sorry, if you just add like one last thing. I became aware of this argument. I'm sure a lot of philosophers have put forth this argument, but I first became aware of it when I learned about Thomas Aquinas. Because it's been a long time since I read his stuff, but if I'm not wrong, like he was one of the original people who put forth like the absence of physical evidence doesn't mean that something doesn't exist. And I always thought about that because I thought, okay, we didn't know that bacteria existed until, you know, a couple hundred years ago when it was Louis Pasteur and whoever else, you know, discovered that there was bacteria, but there has been bacteria for millions of years, right? So I just always think like any or none of these traditions could exist. So it's interesting when we convince ourselves that one is more correct than another, or that none of them are correct, and then we convince other people of that. I don't know. I just wanted to bring that thought out there because we're talking about all these different traditions, and it's interesting that like we all think that one is more correct than another, but there's not really any evidence of any of them, or lack of evidence of any of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful question, and you know, there's no, yeah, I hear you. I do a lot of interfaith work, so I feel very connected with people from all kinds of different traditions, you know, they're doing, I mean, it's incredible what they're doing. They're doing exactly what they should be doing. I don't, there's no right or wrong, I agree. There is one, there's a teacher named Alan Wallace who's I'm pretty known for a long time, pretty close to, and he, very interesting, came back from, I think it was 14 years as a monk in Dharamsala, went to Amherst, got a degree in physics, and then got a doctorate in religious studies at Stanford. But he's written a bunch of books about science, and he's incredibly scientific. He knows all these particle physicists and all kinds of people. He's extraordinary, his sense of physics. And relevant to what you said, he'll say sometimes that in terms of the idea that consciousness emerges from a brain, there's no evidence, there's no neuroscientist or anybody has evidence of that. They just think it must be true, and they start there. So there's that too. Yeah, so we're at a very interesting time here about seeing all these aspects. You know, practice is a direct form of seeing, which I appreciate that about it. And I guess you're here, so maybe that rings for you too. But we shouldn't be blind, no blind faith. No, thank you. And totally honoring. I mean, it's a wonderful mystery how there are, you know, how it is that there's Islam and Christianity and Judaism and Baha'i and, you know, Jain and Zoroastrians. In our world, we're extraordinary beings. And Jain, yeah, I know people. I know Zoroastrian leaders. Just, oh, they're so beautiful. So, I don't know. Yeah, just love it all. We may, some of us may find Buddhism efficacious, you know, that Garrison Keillor word. If it's efficacious and seems to be working, go for it, but that doesn't mean anyone else is wrong. Huh? Efficacious means it works well. Yeah, I know, right? Well, thank you. It's good. Was there a question there? I know you had something. I don't think it's a question. Sorry, it doesn't have to be a question. Just what you said was great.
No, it wasn't really a question. It was just a comment.
Yeah.
Just pointing out is the wrong word, because it's not that anyone disagrees with this, but that the absence of evidence doesn't mean there's no existence of something, I guess, is what I'm saying. And I didn't bring this up, but when you talked about the panel that's upcoming where you're going to talk about evidence of, or like the experience of near-death experience and like consciousness continuing, that's what made me think of the earlier philosophical arguments that the absence of evidence doesn't mean something doesn't exist, if that makes sense. So, yeah, there could be consciousness after death, but just because someone hasn't found it doesn't mean it's not there, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and sometimes I think that, I mean, one of the things I love about interface stuff is it stretches me from being too concrete about things, because I meet these other people who are extraordinary spiritual beings who have come out of a different tradition. So great to see you again. I'm looking at the clock, 8:58. I see Beneth has a hand up. Let's hear from Beneth, and then maybe we'll have to wrap her up.
Hi, super fast question. Is there anything in Buddhism?
Don't have to be fast, just make it relaxed. It's cool.
Okay. I'm curious, is there anything that you know about in Buddhism where it makes a difference of the circumstances of one's death?
Mm. Can you say more about what you're thinking?
About like karma and how rebirth happens.
But what kind of circumstances are you thinking?
Oh, like if you're meditating, you know, and in a really good place and feeling really good and wholehearted and, I don't know, like that.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it's, I mean, I think the particular question of like at the point of death where your mind is at is interesting. And the short answer is, I don't know. But I think the longer answer is cultivating, you know, an attitude of alignment with energy and our continuity helps continue. It does seem that that is true. Ending with a mind of hate probably wouldn't be a good idea. But if we were practicing our whole lives, we probably wouldn't do that anyway. So Don't count on the last minute to get it right. I think that's one message. Yeah, that's how we do practice. Okay, thank you.